Blog Talk Radio.
Online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And the World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future, and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm super fantastic. Happy Friday to you.
It's not often that we get to talk on Fridays. This is good. This is cool.
No, this is an unusual thing. Well, you know what? We hadn't talked about it before the show because we were busy discussing other things, but we're going to have to be on an unusual night again next week, too, so we'll have to work that out. Friday is a candidate, as a matter of fact. But we'll, you know, we don't have to work that out
that's
right
that's
now.
Fine. We'll figure it out.
We don't want to show them how the sausage is made here.
Yeah. We appreciate our listeners making the effort to find us on unusual nights when we have to do this.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for listening, and thanks for being with us on a Friday evening. And as I wrote in my various postings around social media, it's a weird night and a weird time. We're half an hour late, and I just thought that might be a good idea because it was Friday. And I don't know about your house, Stephen, but at my house it takes a little bit longer on Friday for whatever reason to kind of wrap everything up in the evening, and I built a little buffer in. So here we are.
Yeah,
it worked for me too. Yeah. Strange time, strange night, and a fun topic, one of our favorite topics. We're going to be talking about the movies, and I guess this will be our official movie show for the summer, although we can always revisit them later if there are other movies that come along that we feel that we need to talk to. But
we do this at least once a summer, you know, just kind of cover the blockbusters, because you know, often in the summertime we get some good sci-fi. Often the summer blockbusters will include a few of those, and sci-fi tends to touch on the topics that we like to talk about here anyway. And so, we got a few of those tonight to talk about.
Yeah, actually, I think that term is exactly right. What you get in the movies most of the time is sci-fi, not actual science fiction. it's the abbreviated, the toned-down version, right? It's some of the elements, but some of the elements kind of missing or distorted. Different from what you typically get in the literary version, right? I think that's safe to say. Even when a really classic science fiction novel like I, Robot becomes a movie, and it's done fairly intelligently, it's just not the same, right? Rarely do you see the handling of, I don't know, the speculative, extrapolative, if that's the word, view of the world really find its way into the movies, except for visually. Visually, the movies do it, right? They show you a different world, and that's what can be so much fun about them. But yeah, we've done this for years. Is back in the day, we used to say, how well did these movies do in terms of addressing speculist style topics, the kinds of things we talked about in the blog, and I think that's still to point for the discussion we'll be having tonight. I gave it a kind of a harsh name. I called it what did I call it? Dumb futures, smart movie. No, dumb movie, smart futures. And actually, I could have called it the other way around. I just wanted to contrast something dumb and something smart. I'm not saying all these movies are necessarily dumb, and I think it's really important to say I'm not necessarily saying that I dislike a movie because it's dumb. Because frankly, I like Dumb and Dumber. All right, and I don't think it's any dumber than
that. One of my favorite movies.
Yeah,
I'll refrain from giving you the most annoying sound in the world, but
Well, you see, if as a Coloradan, that movie holds a special place in my heart. You know,
John Denver's full of crap.
It's just that whole fantasy sequence he has about what it's going to be like when he gets to Aspen, and actually that first conversation they have, Aspen, yeah, California, sounds good. Just a great movie all the way around. So dumb means. From an intellectual standpoint, not necessarily from what I sit through it, because I can enjoy a dumb movie as well as the next person. But I do think it's important to make a distinction between smart and dumb ideas about the future. I think that that there are some intelligent ideas about the movie, some of which about the future, some of which do occasionally get articulated in movies. I would like to see smart ideas about the future articulated in movies more often. I think that would be very exciting to see, and I hope that in the future we will see that. But I have gone to the trouble. For all the movies I'm going to talk about tonight, I think, I can say something dumb it says about the future and something smart that it says about the future. So hopefully I'm providing a balanced approach here, that, and I'm not going to be too hard on any of them. But what I thought we'd do is we'd start out with the big movies of this summer, talk about them a little bit, and then we could talk about some other movies, just favorite movies from years gone by, and see what they have to do with the future and what they have to say about it.
Okay. All right.
So in no particular order, just kind of the order that I put the pictures up there on the Blog Talk Radio site, we'll start with Pacific Rim.
Okay.
So before we get into how dumb or smart it was, that's a fun movie. I think we can both agree on that.
It's I'm going to tell you, Phil, it was absolutely a great time. Took the kids. We all had a great time. Big robots smashing up big monsters. You know, it was Godzilla as it always should have been, and we had a great time. How about you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I speaking for half of the party. Okay, and we'll come to the other half here in a moment. Yes, I had a great time watching Pacific Rim, and we were talking before the show, and kind of hit upon what it was that that made that movie work so well, is that it was this perfect, I think, realization of the vision of so many Japanese filmmakers throughout the 60s and 70s, making monster movies, making Godzilla movies, and the TV show Ultraman. And when I was a kid, I used to see these things. And, you know, how you viewed them as a child is so different from how you see them even a couple of years later when you're an adolescent or an adult. And it's this fake, cheesy thing, and it's a guy in a rubber suit, and everybody gets a big kick out of it. But when you first see it, when you're a little kid, you're actually seeing monsters and you're seeing robots. And what they did with Pacific Rim is they made it possible to see that again. They brought that vision to the screen in such a way that you couldn't help but see it. It was absolutely there, and it was stunning, visually stunning, and very satisfying. I think the just the action sequences in the movie, which make up a good portion of the movie, I must say. The fights between the robots and the giant sea monsters are everything you would want them to be, pretty much. Would you agree?
Absolutely, beautifully done. Beautifully done.
Yeah. Now, and let me speak for the other half of my party.
Okay.
When we were going out, Soraya and I were, my wife and I were talking about how visually incredible it was. She said, yes, it was. You know, and then I thought, well, maybe it's just too much visuals. Maybe they should have, you know, some dialogue. Maybe somebody should say something. And then they started talking, and I thought, no, it's okay. Go back to just the visuals. That was her – That was her first observation. As we're leaving, she also said, I think I'm the only woman in here. And I said, you know, I'm pretty sure you're the only woman in North America who's gone to see this movie. That's probably not true, but that was, you know.
That's not true. I have a wife who enjoys sci-fi, and she went and had a good time with the rest of us. So.
Oh, well, Soraya likes sci-fi.
The cool wives.
Yeah, Matrix fan and so forth. But we're talking about this. We were talking about if we could go see a movie this weekend, what would we see? And she said, well, I get to pick because you owe me. And I said, why do I owe you? Well, I don't understand. You know, I've been picking winners, right? And she said, no, not last week. That was not a winner. And I said, wait a minute. You cannot – here was my argument. I said, you cannot fault me for Pacific Rim. Because I explained the premise to you, big robots fighting big sea monsters, and that movie
and
delivered on that
got.
Premise, did it not? I accurately described what that movie was going to be about. And she said, you did not. And I said, why not? And she said, because you didn't use the words sucks ass. So, so I'm sorry. For this household, we are 1-for-2 on Pacific Rim. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
But, obviously, it didn't work out for Soraya. Now, over on Facebook, I had posted some, as I was thinking about the plausibility of the story, which is almost nil, right? Even if you accept the premise of giant sea monsters coming through another dimension into a portal in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and you know, even if you accept that piece of it, how it's dealt with in the movie, I think you would agree, Stephen, is not plausible. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I don't want to pick that apart too much because, again, the whole point of the movie is to get to see giant robots.
No, I agree. As a visual experience, I won't disagree with it. As a fun time at the movies. But when you start thinking about it as a kind of, okay, say this ever happened, what would we really do? We wouldn't actually do that. That's my point. We would do other things instead of that. Things that would be less cool.
You'd nuke the probably the first thing we'd do is nuke that a hole in the ocean and try to cover it up or something,
Right, and there is I will give him credit. There is a throwaway line in there about they've tried that and it doesn't work. So I give him credit for at least paying lip service to that, and they do sort of pay lip service to the fact that there would seemingly be more conventional things you could do rather than the thing, the thing they end up doing. But for example, one of the tactics against the monsters that's tried out is they're building these huge coastal walls to keep the monsters out. And to me, I'm thinking, that's a little too late, right? By the time they get to shore, you've really kind of missed the boat or missed the sea monster as far as I'm concerned. I think what you want to do is you want to get that wall right around that fissure, right? Seal that thing off somehow if you possibly can. But we're not going to quibble about any of that. What's good about what that movie has to say about the future? Can you put it in those terms?
Well, I think to say that, whatever challenges we face, we'll find a way to meet them. I think that's if there's a deep message to that movie, I think that might be it.
I couldn't agree more.
We'll rise to the occasion.
Yep, that's what I've got listed as my smart idea about the future from that movie is: if aliens invade, we'll do whatever it takes. We will do whatever it takes to fight them back, right? Until we're gone.
The one line is we're canceling the apocalypse. I think it's always good to cancel the apocalypse.
Absolutely.
If I were a writer, fortune cookie, always cancel the apocalypse. That's a good idea. So
I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
Now the dumb idea about the future is what they actually do, right? I think it's like we've already talked about that. And anyway, it's great fun. It's great fun. It's got very little to tell you about where technology is actually going. Although I do hope we do one day have huge robot suits we can walk around in, if not to fight sea monsters, just because it would be really fun. And I was thinking there might be other applications for that. Maybe construction work or something like that. You can do really fine, detailed construction work as a big robot that. Like a crane wouldn't be able to do or something? Because they lift heavy objects.
I fully expect to see, the thing that we saw in Aliens with Ripley inside of that load lifter. that when you walk around like that, that looks very practical. And
yes.
I think that is a device that no doubt that we will see in a few years. You know, and
I think that
the things that have kept us from being able to do it, the processing power it requires to make something walk and be able to stand upright and things like that, well, we've solved those problems, and we've only done it in the last few years. You know, I think that we will use that to be able to build things like that that will allow us to walk around and lift things much heavier than we could do on our own. So we'll see stuff like that, just not quite that big.
Yeah, well, probably not quite that big, but I don't mind if they're that size. You know, they can make them as big as they want to. Wading out into San Francisco Bay, spot on. I just images like that. I can't get enough of that kind of stuff. Okay, so let's move on. We got a lot of movies to cover here, and we're going to run out of time. You pick one, Stephen. Another big summer blockbuster to talk about.
Well, the first summer blockbuster probably of this year was Iron Man 3.
Okay,
and
I have not seen it, so you tell us all about it.
Okay, I am a huge Iron Man fan. Loved Iron Man, the original Iron Man. Loved Iron Man 2, which made me kind of unique. A lot of people had a lot of bad things to say about Iron Man 2, but I did not. I enjoyed it. And, of course, Avengers. Most people enjoyed that, and I feel like Tony Stark was, probably the big hero in Avengers. There was time for a lot of people to be heroes in that movie, but Tony Stark was it. So here we
go. Great team effort, but I got to say, I think the Hulk stole that movie. Okay, for me anyway, the Hulk.
They could have done a couple of things different with the Hulk in Avengers. I would have enjoyed better. He obviously was able to make the transition to the Hulk, just decide to be the Hulk when he needed to be. I thought it would be interesting.
Yeah.
I'm ready. Boom, I'm the Hulk. And under those circumstances, when he decides, apparently he's in more control of the Hulk than otherwise. If it's pulled out of him, then it's bad news. But apparently that's the rule of with the Hulk from the Avengers, we learned, I guess. But it would have been cooler. You know, he saves Tony Stark by catching him, right?
Yeah.
Tony Stark is out for the count. He's down on the ground. He needs a doctor.
Right.
Hulk rips off his mask, and as he puts his hand on him, it's Bruce's hand.
Oh,
I mean,
well, you're saying that he can change back,
Bruce, too.
But just because he can change to the Hulk doesn't mean he can change back, see? That's the.
Yeah. It would have been an interesting thing. I felt like that was a missed opportunity. But Avengers was a great movie. Loved it. Iron Man 3, not so great. Not a great movie. And that's a shame because it's. Again, I love Iron Man, and the character's great. They just missed a lot of opportunity, completely wasted the Mandarin as a bad guy character, just wasted it. I hated that. And another thing, I mean, they spent a lot of the movie showing that, Tony Stark can control these suits without being anywhere around. Well, that completely takes the element of risk out of the equation. As a storytelling device, I mean, that makes sense. You know, having drones, that makes sense. But, hey, we're not here to make sense. We're here to have fun, right? And if Tony Stark is not in danger, then that, to me, that robs a little of it. And then there's the end, which is even worse. In some ways, he decides he's not going to be Iron Man anymore.
Spoilers.
And, spoilers, sorry.
Not to give it away. Quits being Iron Man. Well, he'll come back in the next Avengers movie.
What he does to show that it doesn't mean anything to him anymore. It's completely out of character. Tony Stark loves technology. He doesn't feel like it's robbing him of any of his humanity. That was never Tony Stark. You know, other people have that angst, but not Tony Stark.
Okay. See, now there you go. Now, if there's a dumb idea about the future being expressed in an Iron Man movie, it's got to be that, right? Having an anti-technology message, or having
an
guy who has been so pro-tech.
Freaking Iron Man, you're got to be kidding.
Oh, yeah. Get out of here.
I mean, Tony Stark is not that guy.
Right,
you know?
Right.
He's the guy that's, making fun of that guy, you know?
Right.
So I just did not like Iron Man 3 for that reason. And, he's almost as a Luddite. in Iron Man 3 by the end of it, and which is a shame. You know, at the same time, though, he, you know, shows that he's this great engineer, and he's, you know, it plays on that in a couple of segments. You know, he engineers solutions that are completely out of the box. That, you know, great. I love that. I love that about, you know, when, you know, so there's even in that, even in this movie that, which was kind of a waste, it was, there were some redeeming parts to it. And, you know, that's, to me, I've always, you mentioned one time, Phil, that after seeing Iron Man, you know, Tony Stark made this McCabe, that, you know, it kind of inspired you to
fix my bike rack. That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, take a crack at solving some problems that you wanted to solve around the house.
Absolutely.
Stuff, so.
He is an inspirational character that way. Absolutely. You know, the ultimate self-made man. He built his own heart. Right. I mean, he's just, yeah. You watch him in action and you say, I want to do that too. I want to make my life better with technology the way Tony Stark did. At least that's how I feel when I watch the original Iron Man. That's the, that's the feeling. I mean,
even Avengers had that for me, you know. I mean,
yeah.
To me, you know, he steps in to this aircraft carrier that's flying around, and you know, he's right at home. That's his element, you know. He's
right.
He's solving problems and everything. Love that. That's sort of an inspiration, you know. I know exactly what you mean when you say that. And yeah, Tony Stark, fun fictional character. Enjoy that. And so yeah, Iron Man 3, a little bit of a waste, and that's a shame, because these movies don't come out all the time.
You know, there's a new Thor movie coming out, I think maybe at Christmas time.
Yeah.
And
I can't
remember the name of it. It's Thor
November,
something.
Yeah.
But the title should have been, what is it?
Go ahead.
What's it called? No, what's it actually called?
Dark something. It'll come to me in a second.
Thor Into Darkness, perhaps. But
yeah.
I think they should have called it More Thor. Wouldn't that have been good? You know?
I've been working out, and now I'm a little
poor. What's that?
I've been working out, and now I'm a little poor. Yeah.
No. You have More Thor,
right.
And then Thor some more, and then Thor 4, right? That would have been perfect. They don't ask me. That's the problem. They don't come to me with for these brilliant marketing ideas. But they could have worked their way up to Thor 4 just like that. It would have been awesome. Anyway, so much for Iron Man. Let's get on to the main event, the thing, I think, the most anticipated movie of the summer, because we've been waiting for this for 3 years, Star Trek Into Darkness. This was the much-awaited sequel to the Star Trek reboot from 3 years ago with the new cast reprising their roles as our original crew of the Enterprise, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and Scotty and Sulu and Uhura and Chekhov, the whole gang. And what a fun ride that was. It's an extremely entertaining movie, action-packed, really suspenseful, I think, in places, really really well-executed storytelling, and overall a pretty darn good movie.
Absolutely. You know, one thing that is always a complaint about the movies is that they don't boldly go and they don't meet new races and things like that.
I'm getting there. I'm going to complain about that. Don't worry, Stephen. That's coming.
Okay.
At the beginning
of this movie, they do it, you know.
Which was awesome. I was very pleased.
They were having contact with a new race and everything. So yeah, that was great. It was a great reintroduction to these characters, and the whole movie was awesome. How big of spoilers are we going to get into here, Phil?
Everybody, we are going to totally spoil Star Trek too. Okay, so Star Trek Into Darkness. Nothing is going to be left undiscussed here, because we're geeking out now. We're on Star Trek, so sorry if you haven't seen it.
Absolutely.
You might as well just keep listening, because Stephen and I are going to give you a better explanation of it than you'll get from actually watching the film. Am I right? go ahead and listen.
It depends on how deep we get into this thing. But anyway,
don't think of it as spoiling. Think of it as we're going to give you this movie, okay? It's free right here on The World Transform. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the fact that the whole world was rebooted is, they continue on that. Things are the same but different. And
right.
In the second movie, they do come across a certain bad guy. And
dude, we're spoiling. It's Khan, man. We can say
it's Khan. Okay. They had met Khan at an early point during the TV series, but this is, you know, chronologically speaking, is still, I think, a year or two before the 5-year mission, right? They talk about the 5-year mission at the end of this. So how is
right.
it that Khan shows up this early? Well, it's because of the events of the first movie that a particular Federation general runs into Khan. And,
right. Right.
And as a result, he tries to use Khan in a very exploitive way, and Khan, of course, is unhappy about that. And so you have a sympathetic villain here. He has reason to hate the Federation, and that's cool. You know, I mean, when it's not black and white completely, that there's shades of gray, that to me makes a more interesting story. And so I very much enjoyed the way they worked this. And of course, it's a complete companion piece to the original Star Trek II.
Yes.
You know,
in fact, it is.
If you're a big fan of that movie,
places,
and most
a scene for scene remake,
still,
almost.
Yeah.
Most of us
still feel that Star Trek II is the best Star Trek movie so far. Well, this is meant to. It's an homage. You know, if you're being critical of this movie, you would say it's a ripoff. I don't see it that way at all.
I don't see it as a ripoff. To me, well, here's the. You know, I can wear various hats talking about this. Okay, so wearing my total geek out Star Trek fanboy hat. Okay, I loved those scenes. Okay, that is so awesome when. Kirk is the one who's getting fried in the radiation, and Spock shows up afterwards. And they've completely turned that scene around. But you're hearing almost exactly the same dialogue, only it's coming out of the other. I mean, that's just awesome.
I found it extremely moving. That
where it really worked for me was where it slightly diverged. And where Kirk said, you know why I did it, and Spock, you know why I did it, and Spock said, because you're my friend, and that hails back to the original movie, but it's not something that these two have said to each other before, which was the core message, right? I have been and always will be your friend, is what Spock said to Kirk in the original movie, and this one finds its way in. And here's what I think. I've got a theory about this new series of Star Trek movies. I believe there is some kind of morphic resonance, if you will, between this timeline and the old timeline, which is why want to put on your critical hat and say, oh, dude, they played the Khan card way too early, which I do think is true. Okay. It's like, you know, they could have waited around and had a Khan movie, but no, they go straight to the Khan movie. You can say that, or you can say, no. All the crucial events that occurred in that universe now need to be played out in this universe. In a new way, because that timeline kind of spun this one off, it has to re-hit all the same points. It is in some ways a mirror image of that one. So because statistically, what should happen is they should never meet Khan, right? It was just a remote chance that they were ever going to find him.
Yeah.
In the first movie, right? In the first TV series. So really, they should never meet Khan. But I think there's some relationship between the one timeline and the next. So we'll continue to see familiar faces, familiar concepts, familiar places from the original series. Only they'll be different, and it will be a fun ride. What I think is really exciting is now they can bring back some other things from the original series, which have never been brought back because they did that with Khan, but then they never. Am I wrong? They never really brought too much else out of the original series into the original movie series, did they?
Well, you know, there was nods to Tribbles in one of the movies, and I mean, but they never,
Yeah, but not like a story arc, right?
You never saw like, Henry Mudd show up in Star Trek.
No, you never saw Harry Mudd, or you never saw the Gateway to Forever, or, you know, some of those kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, they had Romulans and they had Klingons, but there's some great stories back there that I think some of those characters could be brought out and they could do some really interesting things with them. And now that, as you've said, they've started the 5-year mission, I think there's a real opportunity for them to do some of that stuff. And I very much hope that the next movie is a lot like that opening sequence of this current movie, because that was my favorite part. I thought that was so cool that they were, you know, doing a science mission on a planet, and the Prime Directive came up, and Spock was being a hard ass about the Prime Directive, and the aliens were, you know, kind of scary and threatening, and that was just, to me, that was very fun, and it was a better execution of some of that kind of stuff than you ever saw in the original series, I think, because of what you can do with special effects now, and maybe because they know how to pace something like that better, but these were very threatening aliens that we did not want to mess with. And also we had this whole volcano thing going on. Just, I think a really great sequence, and I hope something that speaks well to, that speaks to where the series is going. Now, I've heard that the movie has not done all that well financially, and that could have some impact on what the next movie is going to look like. Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, that would be a shame. I thought it was a well-done Star Trek, and, you know, it's, I enjoyed the first one, enjoyed this one. Some Trekkers just, you know, they don't quite appreciate the reboot as much as I have. But to me, you know, it's I think this is a very interesting experiment. You know, when you reboot a series, you typically ignore that which came before, right?
Right.
Now, when you get a new James Bond, you know, who's now, you know, 2 decades younger than the last James Bond, you know,
right.
you're just asked to forget a lot of that stuff, you know?
Right.
But with this is a literal reboot, and, you know, reboot in the most literal sense that you can have. And it's been fun. It allows them to play in the same sandbox and allow things to be different. But the same.
Right. Somehow
and,
the events.
So it's an interesting way of going about it.
A thing you and I talked about earlier in the summer, I'm perfectly reconciled with and okay with now. Okay. Somehow, the events of the first Star Trek movie rearranged things so that Carol Marcus grew up in the UK, and that's why she has a British accent now. It's not that she's British, but somehow she grew up over there instead of growing up in America where she was supposed to, and that's why she's got an English accent now. Because I was like, they changed that, but I'm like, oh well, maybe. You know, it's the same person. She just grew up someplace else, and that's the accent that she picked up.
Well, Khan is no longer Spanish, but British too. So, you know, oh well.
He's a Sikh. He what? He's not Spanish. He's not British. He's an Indian. Oh yeah, they were as sloppy with that as they ever were. So you know, double kudos for that.
Oh well.
Here's my thinking, okay? You will have heard it here first. I told you about the morphic resonance between the two universes. Now, this is what I would love to see happen. I don't know if they'll do it or not. But there is one arc from the original series that they never went anywhere near in the movies, and that they did finally visit in Star Trek Enterprise, I thought to great effect in a two-part show towards the end of the run of that. And that's the Mirror Mirror universe, right? The universe where Spock has a goatee and all the good guys are bad guys and all the bad guys are good guys, right? Now, I'm hoping, not this next movie, but before the whole series is over, that they hit that parallel universe. And what I'd really love to see is have a good version of, what was his name, Nero show up, right? The bad guy from the first movie. And have him show up and somehow set everything right and reform the two timelines. Now, wouldn't that be something?
Oh man, that's awesome.
I don't know if anyone's thought that far ahead, but that would be cool. So I'm throwing that one out there. You know, it's like have it end with like, you know, they fly past Vulcan and Spock's mom's still alive and Kirk is like, is that right? Is that how things are? And it's like, yeah, of course, it's always been like this. And you know, the end.
Well, you know, what would be cool is a mirror universe version of Khan and Kirk meeting up. You know, and Khan being the great, you know, the great hero, and
yeah,
Kirk
exactly.
being out of control, and course, Khan has to yell, Kirk, you know.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
Right.
That would be good, too, yes. They could, you know, all that's possible, right? It'd be hilarious. I mean, what are the Tribbles like in that universe? They're like really dangerous animals, right? I mean, everything.
The Klingons keep us pet.
Klingons love them over there. That's right. That's funny. No, it's the Mirror Universe, not the Bizarro Universe, right? But speaking of which, we should probably segue over to Man of Steel. Unless, was there anything that we need? Oh, so what's smart and what's dumb about Star Trek Into Darkness? Here's the smart idea about the future, and this is not just Star Trek Into Darkness. This is Star Trek generally, and this is going to Gene Roddenberry's vision, and it's that technology gives us a whole new world. That technology opens up vast new possibilities for the future, and that virtually everything is possible because of the worlds that we open up for ourselves with technology. That's the smart thing about Star Trek, and the wonderful, wonderful thing about Star Trek. So what's dumb? Even though I enjoy it as a fanboy, I think what's a dumb idea is within that framework to just keep telling the same story over and over again, right? So hopefully they won't make any more Khan movies because they've really done it. But I would say
what's dumb is the vision of the future where we explore space in much the same way that we explored the oceans,
in a big ship.
We have this huge crew in a big ship, and we go from star to star. I don't think it'll be quite like that. I think exploration of space will be done with von Neumann probes or something. You know, something is an entirely different way. But it would not be as easy to make a compelling, TV show or movie series out of. So. It certainly works as great entertainment. So
it does, yeah. But you're right.
Love Star Trek.
Its view of how fast technology develops is wrong, and its view of what the important technology is wrong. And we always get that wrong. I think we got it wrong until we hit on computers, and then from there it's right. But that's what everybody always thought. You know, I've talked about there was this book that H.G. Wells wrote called Things to Come, and a pretty good movie made out of it in the late 30s that talks about, it predicts World War II coming, and then it shows this post-war world. And basically there's this utopia that is formed. This great future is brought about by the airmen of the world, the aviators, that aviation is this technology that completely transforms the world and makes it better. And it's like, well, for H.G. Wells, that was this unbelievably transformative technology. So he tended to see it as the thing that would open up the future and give you the bright future you're looking for. By the time you get to the 60s, the technology that people were looking at and thinking that about was space travel. So Star Trek does the same thing with space travel. But when you look at the truly transformative technology, the technology that will really change the world, it's information technology. And Star Trek has IT in it, but they don't grasp how important it is in terms of changing the world. I think that's kind of where it misses the boat, but only because it's a product of its original times.
Yeah. It's a past future.
It is a past future, but a very good one.
But a very good one, one that's and it's a hopeful one. And we can't have too much of that.
No.
Too much hope, it's not such thing.
Yeah, because what they got right is that the future's better and technology helped us get there. That part they got absolutely right. So, okay, now I want to talk about Man of Steel. Now, technically, Man of Steel is not about the future. It's set roughly in the present, as far as we know. Superman stories are always set in the present. But when I talk about what it has to say about the future, I'll be talking about the Kryptonians, and I'm going to look at them as a potential future for humanity. Because they're a highly advanced humanoid species, and so we can sort of project the human future onto the Kryptonian future. So that's my rationale for having a discussion of Man of Steel. Also, Superman, one of his nicknames after Man of Steel is Man of Tomorrow. So I figure, if we're talking about the future, we can always talk about Superman. So. Man of Steel, a reboot of the Superman series, fills us in on some of Superman's young formative years, uses interesting flashbacks to tell us about some things that happened in his childhood, reintroduces the Daily Planet, reintroduces Perry White, reintroduces Lois Lane. Okay, for anyone who had a problem with Perry White being black, grow up and get a life, okay? As far as I'm concerned, the real problem is having Lois
Lane. I hadn't heard anybody complain about that. Is that,
I'm just saying anybody who did.
Something?
If it was, get a life, okay? I haven't I haven't heard it either. But what my point is, the real issue is that Lois was blonde, okay? That, but, you know, I was okay with by the end of the movie, more or less. But that was pretty shocking. That was worse than Carol Marcus suddenly being British, I must say, right? Because it's like Lois is iconically not blonde. You know, setting that aside for a moment, we've got kind of like with Star Trek Into Darkness, we reintroduce the greatest bad guy from the original Superman series of films, General Zod, and he is played, I think, to great effect by, I can't think of the actor's name now, but he brings a lot of energy to that role, makes him a very dislikable character, but also a very compelling character. And so we've got, you know, Superman kind of coming into his own and becoming Superman and meeting up with this villain from the old home world, and the two of them obviously coming into a, you know, tremendous clash with each other. Spoiler, Superman wins. You know, people probably didn't see that coming. And life is good. What's your thoughts, Stephen? How did you like Man of Steel upon reflection, or immediately afterwards, or however you want to frame it?
It was epic. It was done very, very well. The vision of Krypton was very compelling. It was, I thought, beautifully done. I thought that the fact that Krypton was a very stratified society. People were genetically engineered for the roles they were meant to play. You know, if you're going to be a leader, they would genetically engineer you to have that personality, that drive, those talents. If you're going to be a military man like Zod, you're genetically engineered to be a military man. You know, if you're a scientist like Russell Crowe's character Jor-El, is genetically engineered to be that way.
Right.
The first child in living memory for that planet to be born that was not genetically engineered is Superman. Is Kal-El. And I thought that was interesting. You know, that's they show that as part of the reason for the downfall of Krypton, that things had gotten to the point that nothing that was done that was unexpected. You had these certain roles, you filled them, and you lived, you died, and that was it. There's no surprise. There's not room for, you know, the creative weirdo. You wrote about this here recently, Phil, how important that is to have room for people to just be a little off kilter sometimes, and how important that can be to an organization, or even an entire society. So I think that was part of what they were showing there, and I think that's an important message.
I think so too. I what that reminds me of, as I think about it, although in an odd way, but Krypton, as portrayed in Man of Steel, is kind of like Gondor in Lord of the Rings, where you know, it's like their glory days are sort of past them, and particularly in the books, where Tolkien talks about how everybody was, you know, spending all their time reading up on old genealogies and stuff like that. They were very, very fixated on how great they had been in the past, and the particular roles that they had each inherited and had to play.
They were obviously a spacefaring civilization. So you're thinking,
right,
how is it possible that all the Kryptonians are dead? Well, they basically had abandoned space,
right,
which is,
right,
maybe that's a word of caution to us. Don't abandon space. You know, I think it's important for the survival of the human species that we be in more than one place. And,
well, in fact, my smart idea about the future from Man of Steel is that the Kryptonians had built an incredible technological civilization for themselves. The dumb idea is twofold. One is, yeah, they abandoned space, that, you know, the thing that would have added resilience to their civilization, they let it go. And the other one, and I think equally important, is they built this huge civilization that was no fun at all. You know?
Yeah.
Krypton is a drag, right? I mean, it's beautiful. It looks like it always looked in the comics to me. That was the thing that that I really liked.
Yeah, we
have
never
really
seen that in a live-action movie before.
The
Krypton that we saw in the original Christopher Reeve movie, very boring looking. Looked like they filmed it in a mall. You know,
it was a cool vision, but it was not like Krypton in the comics, and not nearly as interesting as what we saw in this. Well, they're flying around on bugs, and I remember that from my childhood, that they did that, right? They had these big bugs they flew around on. I just thought that was really cool that they brought that in. And also in the Krypton sequence, I have to say, I was very impressed that Jor-El was just a total badass, right? You know, you don't mess with Jor-El. He was kind of an action hero in his own right. And that makes sense, right? It's where his son gets it, you know? He gets it from a father who had those kinds of capabilities. Now, I have a few issues with Man of Steel that go beyond Lois being blonde, just kind of around the tone of the movie. Just like Krypton is no fun, I think Superman should be fun. I think that the one thing that was really missing was Clark Kent bumbling around.
Clark Kent was never – it was hardly in this movie.
Yeah. We didn't have Clark, and we didn't have the fun banter at the Daily Planet, and we didn't have the fun banter between Clark and Lois. And that's definitely it was, you know, I felt like it was missing. Also, this is a very troubled young Superman, and I feel like they're taking a page from the book of The Dark Knight, and I hope that he's okay by the next one. I hope they inject a little more fun into it, and then we have a happier and more confident Superman. Because what's the point of being Superman if you're not having a good time? You know, that's my. That's my one little critique there. You know, if you might as well enjoy being Superman, because that's about the best deal anybody's ever going to get, I think.
You could look at this. You could look at the movie a little bit as a metaphorical story of the singularity in a way. Okay,
and
let me explain my. Let me if I'm going to get this deep about it. Let me explain myself just a little bit. Krypton was obviously a post singularity society. Okay, I mean they had what amounted to utility fog. They showed that a number of times.
Yep.
And obviously a great computation. There were an interstellar civilization, at least had been in their glory days that had passed. And the message that Jor-El had for his son Kal-El was that these people, these humans, they have promise, and one day they will join you in the sun. And what are we talking about? I think part of what he was talking about is, you will have a chance to guide them through this singularity of them.
Oh.
I think that there was a little bit of a nod to that. And,
oh, interesting. I didn't pick up on that.
Because obviously when if an interstellar civilization makes contact with Earth, what happens is it would tend to affect the development of our planet, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
And, I think there's a little bit of a nod to that, because it's not just Superman in a space pod. There's other Kryptonian technology all around in this particular movie, and you see that, I see that as potential plot point. You know, you could have Lex Luthor coming out as a hero here. You know, we're being invaded in a way by all this technology we need to develop. You could see that developing as, you know, him coming out sort of as a hero, but obviously put against the heroic Superman. So that could be a more interesting version of the Lex Luthor Superman story, that they're both heroes in their own way.
Interesting. Well, we'll see. There was that one truck that said LexCorp on it. So,
he obviously exists there.
Yeah, we'll see him.
They just hadn't introduced the character.
Yeah, that will be interesting to see. And that does bring me back to one other small criticism I have of the movie. This is a problem that occurs with superhero movies generally. It's especially bad with all the Marvel characters. It is particularly bad with Spider-Man, which is that, like, if the person at the center of the story never existed, the world might be a little bit better off anyway, right? You know what I mean? It's like Spider-Man and his, like, circle of friends, he's the only good guy, right? Everybody he knows turns into a villain who goes on a rampage and tries to wipe out New York City.
The thing that makes Spider-Man also, it happens to make all these bad guys that he has to fight.
Exactly. And in this case, it's even worse.
If it weren't for that, then everybody would be better off. Yeah.
It's like if they hadn't sent their Kryptonian son to Earth, half of Metropolis wouldn't have been flattened by this general, right? I mean, so far, having Superman show up is kind of a net deficit to the planet, right? Now, eventually, he'll make up for that. But I think that's a little bit of a problem if you think about those kinds of things, which you shouldn't, because that's nerdy. It's not geeky. It's nerdy.
don't be a nerd, guys.
Yeah.
That's all.
I'm sorry. When I overgeek, sometimes I go into nerd. So, all right. Maybe we should hit some of these older movies, unless you had something else to say about one of the big epics this summer.
Well, I highly recommend seeing Oblivion. It didn't get the same attention that a lot of the bigger blockbusters got. It's Tom Cruise. It's post an alien invasion apocalypse type story. And it's a cool story. I don't want to spoil it. I don't think you've seen it, Phil. And but I do highly recommend it. Great sci-fi, and it does have some interesting things to say. It's smart, in addition to being good entertainment. So yeah, Oblivion's good. Looking forward to Elysium. It hadn't come out just yet, but that's going to be an interesting one to talk about, because it plays on the same thing we always. It's the same complaint that we always get, that the rich people will inherit the future, and the poor people will inherit the crap, and which has not been the case. It has not
been
the case at all.
And as I think we can agree, that's the dumb idea about the future from Elysium, right? Just from the trailer.
And it's not just Elysium. A lot of sci-fi movies suffer from that.
Yeah, they do. That's a big. I mean, they got to create the drama somehow. So they went that route, and I think that's really unfortunate that. Because the smart idea is very cool. Elysium gets some things right, at least from the trailer. I mean, we're talking about a trailer, right? We haven't actually seen a movie, so we shouldn't spend too much time on it until we've seen the movie. But the smart idea is that technology is going to enable this profoundly improved world. And then the dumb idea is that it's just for this elite, and most people won't get it, and most people will be living in a... Dystopias are not a smart idea about the future. Dystopias are a dumb idea about the future. I had listed the dumbest futures... all come from these awesome Charlton Heston movies of the late 60s and early 70s, right? Soylent Green, Omega Man, Planet of the Apes. Now,
love those movies, and they're all dystopian movies.
Yes,
so
they're great fun. Yeah. Every one of them great fun. The smart idea that you get about the future from those movies is that things could take a horrible and completely unexpected turn, and that's true. Things could go in a really bad direction for us, even still. We never give any guarantees that things are going to work out. We just think they probably will. But the dumb idea is the way they actually go in those movies, particularly Planet of the Apes, although it's probably the most fun of the three. But Omega Man actually has resonance with World War Z. I don't know. Did you see World War Z?
I have not. So tell me
okay, I haven't seen it either.
Here's the thing. I read the novel and loved it. The novel, as I was reading it, I said, you know what, this is awesome, but it's unfilmable. And they didn't, because it's an oral history, it's a cast of thousands, it's not any one person's story, it's just the story of this war that had taken place 10 years earlier, where humanity almost was wiped out by zombies, okay?
Right.
And so what they were trying to do is collect the stories so that we could pass this on, and so that's an oral history. That's what the novel was. And so, of course, they didn't try to film that. They went with a central character, Brad Pitt's character, and they made a movie about him and his character. Well, that's fine. It's not the novel, but it's where it is. It's like the best zombie movie ever. So, what'd you think, Bill?
I haven't seen it. I was hoping to go see it this week, and I had no opportunity to do it. So I'm also not prepared to actually discuss World War Z. But I can say something about the zombie genre generally. From
okay. All right.
Not even Omega Man. I guess it goes back to Night of the Living Dead up through World War Z, which is they give us a smart idea about the future, which is that things can go completely out of control. That something can come along. And often in zombie movies, it's our technology. In the remake of Omega Man, and I think probably in the original, it's we cause it to happen, right? That it's biotechnology that goes out of control that leads to the zombie apocalypse, and that's often the case. You have things like Walking Dead where we just don't know; it just started happening, right? Night of the Living Dead is like that, and I think in World War Z. It is some technology that got out of control. Is that right in the book?
Yeah.
In the book, it
was basically a disease that was caused by the relocation of massive populations of people into new and different areas after the flooding for the Seven Gorges Dam. You know, what they did was they moved whole towns, whole little cities that were in those river valleys were moved to new places. And in doing so, they stumbled upon a disease that they would not have stumbled upon otherwise by moving these entire populations to new areas. So that's what got it started, apparently, in the book. So I don't know if they really dealt with that in the movie or not.
Well, I don't either. But anyway, the point is, this genre tells us that things could get completely out of control and go south. And I think that's true. I don't think it'll be reanimated corpses. I'm not worried about that happening. I don't think that will ever be a disease.
It could be a problem. So, yeah. Interesting book, and I do highly recommend the book, and I hope that the movie does it justice.
Well, that is just about going to do it for us this evening. I do want to thank Jab for all of his great comments in the chat room tonight. Jab, and I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about some of the movies that you've been bringing up. But The Sixth Day with Arnold Schwarzenegger is awesome kind of projection of, you know, technology getting out of hand with you like that. So thanks for all those comments, Jab. Appreciate that. We will be back on next week on a date that we haven't announced yet. So I will get that announcement up as soon as Stephen and I have decided when it will be. Thanks, everyone, for being with us this evening. And Stephen, what's our music?
Our music tonight is Four Leaf Clover by Jan Closé.
Four Leaf Clover by Jan Closé. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. And what fun talking about the movies. We'll have to do this again next week. Whatever night we're on, we're going to be concluding our list of 100 isms. So it'll be a special 90-minute program. Look forward to having you all with us for that. And until next time, live to see it. But
maybe if we keep on looking, there'll be a little pot of gold for us, waiting over by the rainbow's end, with a little bit of time for us to spend, knowing that there'll be more than enough. Four-leaf clover, I wanna give in to you.